Coming up, Lucky Severson on a controversial new law in Mississippi. Critics say in the name of religious freedom, it would permit people of faith to discriminate against gays. And Kim Lawton talks to a prominent ethicist about the world's moral obligations to record numbers of refugees. Also, after last year's earthquake, the broken antiquities of Nepal. Brenda Sam Lazaro reports that some Nepalese don't much care whether the temples they still use are restored.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us this season of allergies and colds. Amid rumors of a possible split, the United Methodist Church, the second largest Protestant denomination in the U.S., decided yet again to delay any decisions on whether to accept same-sex marriage or ordained LGBT clergy. The church voted instead to appoint a commission that would examine every paragraph of the denomination's Book of Discipline to look for possible revisions regarding human sexuality. The issues have been controversial within the church ever since it first decided in 1972 that homosexuality was incompatible with Christian teaching.
If we want a healthy future for United Methodism, we need to reaffirm traditional Christian teachings.
It's time for people to look beyond their narrow-minded readings of Holy Scripture and to see the gospel of love that is embedded within that text, a gospel that reaches to the ends of the earth for all people.
The Methodists also considered expanding their role in what's known as the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS movement, that seeks to pressure Israel. But the various proposals were rejected. Delegates did vote to withdraw from the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, a group that critics see as more anti-Israel than pro-peace. The Supreme Court this week declined to rule in a highly watched case about the extent to which faith-based nonprofits can be exempt from the government's mandate that employers provide contraception coverage for employees. Citing legal briefs with possible compromises, the justices threw out all previous rulings and told lower courts to revisit the issue. In the meantime, the court said religious groups may not be fined if they don't comply. The case was brought by a group of nuns, the Little Sisters of the Poor, and other religious nonprofits who said their religious freedom was being violated. Faith groups come down on both sides of the issue. Leaders of the Anti-Defamation League are expressing concern about what they describe as a troubling degree of stereotyping and prejudice in campaign rhetoric this election season. The ADL was founded in 1913 to fight anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry. At the ADL Leadership Summit in Washington this week, officials criticized uncivil rhetoric in both parties. Jonathan Greenblatt is the group's new CEO.
It's become okay to slander people, again, based on what they believe or where they're from or who they love. We don't think that's okay.
We have a Lucky Severson story today about the new law in Mississippi that critics say permits discrimination against gays. Its supporters say it's needed to allow people of faith to act in accordance with their beliefs. Religious groups are divided over the issue.
Protesters, most of them angry about a new wide-sweeping Mississippi law that gives persons and businesses, because of their religious beliefs, the right to deny service to gays. Ron Mattis is a political liaison for the Mississippi District of the United Pentecostal Church. He was instrumental in getting the controversial law passed.
Christians are encountering the discrimination here. Christians are the ones that are feeling that there's going to be repercussions for taking a stand as a result of their faith. And this bill, just all it says is that the government isn't going to get involved in allowing discrimination against people of faith.
The law is called the Protecting Freedom of Conscience from Government Discrimination Act. The key question is, who is being discriminated against? Before the law, because of their religious conviction, people could be penalized because they wouldn't hire gays or sell to them or do business with them. On the other hand, people can now be fired or not hired because they're gay, and they can be denied many other services. This is United Methodist Pastor Chris Donald.
Well, I think what it does is it creates a division among the people of Mississippi, and it enables people who have bigoted beliefs to whitewash them with the language of religion and to refuse to serve people because of their sexual orientation or their gender expression.
This is Russell Moore, the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention.
And so I think that just as there are sometimes some Christians who have wanted to drive everyone who disagrees with us out of the public square, I think that we're facing some secularists who would like to drive people of sincerely held religious conviction out of the public square as well.
For some, the feeling that people of faith are under siege grew dramatically after the Supreme Court legalized gay marriage in 2015. And now Mattis worries that the government could force clergy to officiate at gay weddings.
So there's a potential, say, for a pastor in those communities, one of those communities, to have concerns that if he declined to officiate at a wedding ceremony, that he could be fined by his local government for declining to take part on account of his sincerely held religious beliefs.
It's a law that wasn't necessary, and it's an answer to something that's not a problem.
Bishop Brian Sage of the Episcopal Diocese of Mississippi says that the First Amendment already protects the clergy.
They didn't need to be worried about the state coming in and telling them what to do, because they have, as clergy and as ministers of the gospel, they have the right to decline to do any service for any reason.
I think there are maybe half a dozen reasons why this law is unconstitutional.
Matt Steffi is a professor at the Mississippi College School of Law.
You know, there is a long and strong line of authority from the Supreme Court that says government simply cannot use religious criteria or religious beliefs, a certain set of them, as the basis for government action.
Governor, can you tell us why you signed the bill?
Sure, because I think it's a good bill. I think it protects the religious freedom of people who have deeply held religious beliefs, and so did the legislature, and so did the majority of the people of the state of Mississippi, so we signed it into law.
Mississippi is very divided on this issue.
Rabbi Matt Dreffen is the secretary of the Mississippi Religious Leadership Conference. He says he doesn't know anyone in the conference who likes the law.
Religious liberty is important, and practicing your religion is important, but at no point should it impact another person who does not believe that. And that's what this allows to happen.
This allows for men or women who work in a county clerk's office to treat one segment of the population different than another segment of the population.
As in 2015, when a county clerk in Kentucky, Kim Davis, refused to issue a marriage license to a gay couple.
I just want to serve my neighbors quietly without violating my conscience.
Pastor Donald, who is the chaplain at Millsap College, says the answer to that dilemma can be found in Scripture.
An example from Scripture is the centurion Cornelius. He became a Christian, and he was a soldier in the Roman army, and the early Christian church was deeply pacifist, very anti-violence. And the story is that Cornelius left his job as a soldier because it was incompatible with his Christian faith. If a civil servant's unable to do their job because of their Christian faith, then they need to leave their job.
Under the Mississippi law, an adoption agency could refuse a child to a gay couple. Mattis believes that is not a problem.
Now, what they would do is they would say, you know what, and we can't provide that service because it's contrary to our sincerely held religious beliefs and our charter, you know, how we operate. However, I'd love to provide you a referral to organizations that would.
It would cover, for example, a florist or a hotel operator deciding that the couple in front of them had had sex before or outside each of their marital relationships and declined to serve them.
In fact, a florist in Oregon was found guilty of violating state laws and the rights of a gay couple after she refused to arrange flowers for their wedding. Her case is now on appeal. And in Washington, a baker who refused to make a cake for a gay couple's wedding was ordered to pay the couple $135,000. There have been a handful of cases around the country, but apparently not in Mississippi.
I believe there have been none. In fact, there have certainly been no well-publicized cases.
According to the ACLU, there are about 100 bills in legislatures across the country that use religion as a justification to refuse service to gay people. At the same time, there doesn't seem to be very many actual complaints from people of faith that they're being unjustly prosecuted.
This is live and let live. We're not trying to say that homosexual couples can't get married. That's the law of the land. The Supreme Court says so. All we're trying to say is that religious liberty is equally deserving of protection, and people of faith are deserving of being able to act in accordance with those beliefs without being discriminated against by their government.
Many here are concerned that the law is going to attract the wrong kind of attention from Mississippi and that there will be boycotts. The most serious threat, though, may be a lawsuit filed by the ACLU that claims the Mississippi law violates the due process and the equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson, Jackson, Mississippi.
This coming week, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is convening the first World Humanitarian Summit. He called the meeting because he said we're witnessing the highest level of human suffering since the Second World War. A major part of that suffering is record numbers of people who have been displaced from their homes. Kim Lawton sat down with prominent ethicist Father David Hollenbach to talk about the moral obligations the international community has to these refugees.
The images can be overwhelming, and they don't let up. Millions of people from across the globe forced from their homes because of conflict and social upheaval. According to the United Nations, there are more than 60 million displaced people in the world today, the most since World War II. In 2015 alone, some 8 million people were displaced, the largest number ever recorded in a single year.
I'm calling it humanity in crisis.
Professor David Hollenbach is director of the Center for Human Rights and International Justice at Boston College. He spent last fall at the Library of Congress in Washington researching the global refugee crisis.
These people have no choice about moving. The conditions they face, often due to conflict, put their most basic human rights on the line.
As a Roman Catholic theologian and an ethicist, Hollenbach believes members of the international community, and especially the United States, have a moral obligation to find solutions.
One, there's a severe need. Secondly, we have the capability to do something about it. If you can't swim, you're not obligated to jump in a river to save a drowning child and cause another death to occur on top. But if you're a good swimmer, you've got an obligation to jump in and help that kid who's in danger of drowning. And capability means, you know, there can be responsibility.
Hollenbach also cites the principle known as moral proximity, the idea that people have special responsibilities toward those with whom they share a kinship or connection.
We're not next door to Syria or South Sudan or Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, but we have enough awareness of what's going on so that I would argue we have moral proximity to those needs.
Specifically in the Middle East refugee crisis, Hollenbach believes the U.S. has moral responsibilities because of its previous involvement in that part of the world.
Our intervention in Iraq was the beginning of a set of circumstances that have led to the unweaving of the fabric of the society in that region. And therefore, I would say, though we are not the cause of this displacement, our intervention in Iraq was one of the occasions that led to this displacement.
Hollenbach says moral obligations exist on several levels. One is governmental.
The rich nations of the North, like us, have the capability and therefore the responsibility to admit a larger number of asylum seekers, and even more, I would say, to assist these poorer countries who are already hosting most of the world's refugees. The funds being provided for this burden sharing by us in the North need to be substantially increased.
In addition, he argues that governmental duties include working for peace and advocating for policies that will provide stable societies so that people can return to their homes. And he says individuals have responsibilities as well.
Many of the organizations that respond to those in most need who are displaced like this are faith-based organizations connected with churches, with synagogues, even increasingly now some with mosques. And we can help that through our participation in our own religious community's effort to respond.
Hollenbach worries that reluctance to help refugees can too often be motivated by bigotry.
Most of these people are either Muslim or African, and I don't think it's unfair to say that a certain kind of religious or racial antipathy toward those who are different from us is operative.
He disagrees with those who cite security concerns as a reason not to help refugees.
There's not a lot of evidence that terrorists have come into this country as refugees. Most of the people that have been involved in these terrorist activities are alienated young men who are westernized, but who have become alienated from the environment in which they're living.
Hollenbach believes the world must recover a sense of what he calls the universality of human dignity, a recognition that the crisis represents people and not just numbers.
And to the degree that we can see them as genuine, real people, we recognize that they are our brothers and sisters.
The scope of the crisis may be daunting, but Hollenbach says he takes encouragement from people he has met, such as a Somali woman named Halima, who laughed with him in an African refugee camp.
The laughter opened up the door to recognize our common humanity, I think. Well, that's the sort of story that has motivated me to keep working on some of these issues, even though sometimes it seems tremendously depressing to think about all this struggle and suffering. But when I get a little depressed about it, I try to remember Halima's smile. And when I remember that, I say, we got to keep trying.
I'm Kim Lawton in Washington.
We have a Fred DeSam Lazaro story now about a culture clash in Nepal after last year's earthquake. Western scholars want to repair the broken, priceless antiquities, but it turns out that many of the local residents don't care much whether the temples they still use are restored.
Until now, the major concern in Nepal has been the humanitarian response and the slow pace of rebuilding, as hundreds of thousands of quake survivors remain in flimsy temporary shelters. But for historians, archaeologists, and even tourism promoters, there's another worry. The earthquake did extensive damage to Nepal's historic temples, structures anywhere from 200 to 1400 years old.
The temples of Nepal are absolutely unique. They are inscribed in the World Heritage List. So you will find such a dense concentration of cultural heritage in almost no country of the world. It is an exceptional mix of religions. So many temples are Hindu and Buddhist at the same time.
Hinduism has deep and intersecting roots here with Buddhism, whose founder, Gautama Buddha, was born in what is today Nepal, some 2,600 years ago. Scholars say most Nepalese beliefs and practices are a fusion of the two ancient faiths. The rich cultural heritage is also a living one, says Christian Manhart of the United Nations Cultural Organization, UNESCO.
So it is not just beautiful monuments which are there for tourists, but they are used, all of them are used by the people of the country. So it's a very strong living culture.
And that adds more complication to the rebuilding efforts, a clash between Western and Eastern priorities and sensibilities.
We don't have romanticism with the historical patina. So this is, you know, different way of looking to the monument as a Westerner eye and as the local people here.
Rohit Ranjitkar is with a non-profit organization called the Kathmandu Valley Preservation Trust. He says for most Nepalis, these historic sites are first and foremost places of active worship.
Basically, they have the attachment with the God and the place, the religious activities, not with the architecture. The site is important. You know, for them, the temple will be rebuilt or not rebuilt, it does not make any difference.
Ranjitkar's group has been rebuilding temples for more than two decades, with funding mostly from private Western donors. The trust's work likely helped some structures withstand the quake, he says, and it moved swiftly after the temblor to salvage what it could of others that were destroyed.
So these are all the strut from the lost temple, from the earthquake, so we all rescue from the rubble.
They are among thousands of icons, statues, and timbers now housed in makeshift storage until they can be restored to their original temples.
And this is the one of the oldest section of the whole palace from 1627. We started actually renovating this building since 2008.
The temples and monuments were often part of royal palace complexes. It's here that the delicate balancing act between Western or international norms and local traditions and concerns comes into play.
So this is about 300 years old, and this is
last year.
Here, Ranjitkar explained the decision to repair weathered 300-year-old architectural elements with brand new work, going against the grain of many art historians who would have left the historic structure alone.
The people who can still do that, we need to promote them. If we don't do this, then this skill will be also lost.
He says one priority is to preserve the skills and artisanship handed down the generations over centuries, but disappearing in a modern world economy.
Three days to make this.
Wow.
The craftsmen mainly come from lower socioeconomic classes or castes and have not enjoyed high social standing. Many have gone into other work, notably as laborers in oil-rich Gulf states. There's also a shortage of recorded information to guide a rebuilding that's faithful to the original temple design. Shukra Sagar Shrestha, a retired archaeologist, spends much of his time gathering old photographs, documents, and drawings to help the artisans. And he studies the ancient inscriptions and intricate carvings of these temple icons. This series, for example, is a kind of do's and don'ts, he says, a path to either heaven or hell in one's next life.
Because you gave your daughter to marry, but you accepted money.
So he has been put into a cauldron of boiling water because he accepted a dowry for his daughter.
Exactly.
The UN estimates it will take at least 10 years and about $200 million to restore all the icons and monuments in Nepal's heritage sites to their pre-earthquake location and condition. For this part of the rebuilding, Ranjitkar says he leans toward a more Western or international preference, repairing a lot of the woodwork instead of replacing it.
Saving as much as possible the historical element, not replacing the whole thing. The local people, they don't like it. They think like, this is not good, this is not auspicious. In our religion, we don't worship the image which is broken or which is chipped out. So when you have some damage in the image, so people normally replace with the new one. They don't use the old one. For them, the image has to be complete.
So as the rebuilding gets into full swing, Ranjitkar says one of his main tasks will be to spend more time with priests and worshippers who prefer the shiny and new, trying to convince them of the virtue of the ancient artisanship and to consider another set of pilgrims to the temple, tourists. Their reverence is mainly for the historic architectural patina, and their dollars are a critical engine in the local economy. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSanLazaro in Kathmandu.
On our calendar, Baha'is celebrate the declaration of the Bab. Baha'is believe the Bab, which means the gate, was the messenger of God who first sounded the call for the unity of all cultures, nations, and religions. Finally, we note an interesting story in the Daily Beast this week about former U.S. Senator Robert Bennett of Utah, a moderate Republican and a Mormon, who died earlier this month. According to his family, Bennett was outraged by the anti-Muslim rhetoric of Donald Trump. So, in his last months, Bennett apologized personally to as many Muslims as he could for his party's apparent acceptance of Trump's anti-immigrant speech. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's much more on our website. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.